Fellas, you know Degree Cool Rush deodorant, right? Well, last year they changed the formula, and guys were mad about it. One dude even started a petition. So guess what? Degree heard us, admitted they messed up, and brought the original Cool Rush scent back exactly how it was. And it's in Walmart, Target, and other stores now for under $4. So grab some and remember why its cool, crisp, and fresh scent made it the number one men's antiperspirant for the last decade. Degree Cool Rush is back, and it smells like victory for all of us.
Starting a business can seem like a daunting task, unless you have a partner like Shopify. They have the tools you need to start and grow your business. From designing a website to marketing to selling and beyond, Shopify can help with everything you need. There's a reason millions of companies like Mattel, Heinz, and Allbirds continue to trust and use them. With Shopify on your side, turn your big business idea into... Sign up for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/special offer.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. I'm here, Brian Kilmeade Show, closing out the week. This hour, we'll be joined by Victoria Coates, former Deputy National Security Advisor to President Trump, first term, and Congressman Randy Fine. In 15 minutes, he replaced Michael Waltz in Congress. Now, Michael Waltz is going to be going to the U.N., we'll talk about a lot of that. And today, also, the President of the United States last night was speaking at the University of Alabama commencement address. And if you're looking for AOC, she's hosting a big town hall in Jackson Heights, Queens, where she actually represents. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's been 50 days. 50 days of pain and suffering. My children and I had to watch Trump and Bukele's administration laugh over pain.
You know, that is the wife of Kilmore, the MS-13 guy, human trafficker, who beat her twice. Yeah, we got to go rally for her, who's gotten on the GoFundMe page over $250,000. Illegal immigration is front and center. Courts are trying to stop Trump and have his success. They're going to end up all these cases. They're going to end up at the Supreme Court. Then we'll see what happens.
Number two.
Why was Mike Waltz let go?
So he wasn't let go. He is being made ambassador to the United Nations, which, of course, is a Senate-confirmed position. I think you can make a good argument that it's a promotion.
Really? Shake up at 1600. National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, good friend of the show, exits for the UN, and Rubio fills in. What does it mean for Russia, Ukraine, Iran, Israel, and our foreign policy?
Number one.
A lot of people like to talk about tariffs. Well, tariffs is exactly what they were doing for us. You know, when you want to defend that, they're a beautiful thing for us. If you can use them, if you can get away with using them, it's going to make us very rich.
So, by the way, we just added 177,000 jobs. The market loves it. It's up 500 points. That is 22,000 more than expected. The economy, we're about to start talking with China, perhaps. We're looking at tariffs. The president's budget, he just submitted it, and the latest on the big, beautiful bill. Meanwhile, 19 Republicans, led by Chip Roy, Freedom Caucus and others, wrote a letter saying, we have to cut Medicaid. President said, can't cut that. This is going to be tough. Big, beautiful bill, but it's going to get done. So first off, I think we added 177,000 jobs. Now, DOGE was responsible for job losses because it was intentional. They have to cut the federal workforce. But to add that many jobs in the middle of all this uncertainty on the massive tariffs, global tariffs, is pretty significant. Now to this story. China's considering trade talks with the U.S., but has conditions. The China's Commerce Ministry is evaluating what they say is the U.S. offer to talk, but will only engage in negotiations if Washington cancels its tariffs on Chinese goods. And that's not going to happen. It's at 145%. I could see him cutting it down to 125. Quote, if the United States does not correct its wrong unilateral trade tariff measures, it means the United States has no sincerity. They want us to remove the tariffs first. Show sincerity. I don't know how you do that. Says we have already asked to start talks. We haven't confirmed then that. It looks like the producers in China are feeling major pain. Why? The EU stood up and said, just because you're producing goods and can't bring them to the U.S. at that rate, you cannot dump them here. So therefore, they got all these products, all this production, nowhere to go, which means they're going to stop making the products. China is 145%. They did not qualify for the 90-day pause that every other nation qualified. Trump wants to start talking by talking with President Xi at the top. But China is worried about it. They want to start at a lower level. China's worried that Trump will do something, I guess, unpredictable and embarrass President Xi when they're in a one-on-one setting. China has also has a feeling the pain in the trade fight, but they are calling on their people to absorb the pain, to win this fight that America started. And they're mocking us regularly. How do we know? Look at TikTok. I mean, TikTok is full of anti-Americanism and anti-American posts and manufacturer to manufacturer on your algorithm trying to get you to buy stuff. So it shows to show you this is no algorithm that's not controlled by China. TikTok should have been banned a long time ago. In reality, China has this issue. They need to look strong, but their economy is weak. Housing crisis is real. Poor consumer confidence is everywhere. China has $300 billion trade surplus with the U.S. Trump will not stand for that. He's not. And I think that that's where we begin. How do you rebalance? Meanwhile, in the meantime, I think that they're going to have to probably subsidize our farmers because our farmers need to sell to China. So far, we're not able to get another market for it. Some say Brazil. I'm not sure what they can do. So we'll see where they stand. Here's what J.D. Vance told Brett last night about the economy, where we're going, because it did contract, and it was stunning news. The market hated it and then got used to it. Cut five.
So the first thing is, when you talk about the economy, this is Joe Biden's economy, and we inherited $2 trillion of debt, the highest peacetime deficits in American history, a $1.2 trillion trade deficit, which fundamentally means we're not making enough of our own stuff. And the president came in and he said, this is not always going to be easy. It would have been very easy for Donald Trump to do what administrations past have done, which is borrow a lot of money and continue fueling the national debt. He said, no, we need a reset.
And that's just it. And it starts with China. And I just think the market could really use the India deal, the South Korea deal. I think maybe South Korea's first now. I thought for a while it would have been India and Japan. You do those three, and then the EU comes to play ball. You can ignore China's calls for a while. Again, the market just wants a certainty. Got much more to talk about, but just to give you an idea of what else is happening on the economy, President Trump submitted it today, just a skinny budget. To know where we stand and to know, you know, where Ways and Means can go with this and how it relates to the tax cuts and the big, beautiful bill that's coming down the pike. In the skinny budget, we could say this. It calls for deep cuts in foreign aid, kind of knew that, cuts in renewable energy, increasing spending for the border and national security and the Pentagon. That, according to officials, Trump's budget amounts to another declaration of war on the status quo, according to critics of it. Here is more from J.D. Vance on China, Cut 7.
And I'll ask all of you, the workers and the corporate leadership assembled here today, a very simple question. Do you want to ship American jobs off to the People's Republic of China? No. Do you want to rely on foreign corporations to make the things that you need in your homes and your families need every single day? No. So why don't we rebuild America's middle class? Why don't we rebuild American manufacturing? And why don't we rebuild American industry just like you're doing right here? And isn't it nice to have an administration that supports you for a change?
So that he was at a steel mill yesterday. Vice President, according to Mark Halperin, and I agree, he says he's as powerful a vice president as we've had since Dick Cheney. No question. President has a lot of faith in him, does not worry about consolidating power. You know that he gave Elon Musk a lot of rope, and he's given J.D. Vance a lot of responsibility, and he's obviously very competent. I just worry about his foreign policy. I think it's much different than mine. It's more close to Marco Rubio when he was a senator. And before we move on, just on the big, beautiful bill, this is now out on the on X, a letter led by Chip Roy, signed by 19 others. These lawmakers said the GOP conference must pursue meaningful reforms in reconciliation, including eliminating the enhanced federal matching funds for expanded Medicaid. I agree with you. But what happened when Obamacare passed, he said, four states, I have money for you to help with your state aid called Medicaid. Could be Medi-Cal, wherever you are, but it's the Medicaid. And what happens is if you take it, you get on the hook for it. It's almost like a drug. And then when you have a different president comes in, not Joe Biden, but Donald Trump, they go, yeah, I'm not going to continue to write, give checks two states to pay for state aid, which were for the impoverished or the distressed in case of emergency. But what you do is you expand this aid to people, and then you look like the, when you come into power, you say, we can't afford this. Well, you look like the one taking away from poor people when it was just extended beyond what the program was meant to be. And that's what they're calling for. But Trump has come out and said, I'm not going to touch Medicaid. Well, the problem is, if you leave it currently where it is, how are you going to find a way to cut $626 billion over the next decade in order to make the tax cut bill work? And that's what the speaker's got to work out. And the fact that Chip Roy put this out now, they want to kind of divide the lines and let the American people know behind closed doors, there's going to be a lot of secret. There's going to be a lot of bargaining. But going in, this is my problem. So during our show yesterday, we got the bad news. My view, National Security Advisor Michael Waltz is out. He's going to move 2 hours later. We find out he's not really out. He's going to go over to the UN ambassadorship right here in New York City, which means I imagine he's going to be on our show a lot, be available. And, you know, you saw what Nikki Haley did with that job. I mean, it was a cabinet position for her. She really had a stake in foreign policy, let the world know where we stood. And I think she really made a lot of name for herself there. And I think that I think Michael Waltz can make it work, too. But the story behind the scenes is I'll try to bring forward and we'll speculate and see what his confirmation will be like when we come back. Congressman Randy Fine, we'll talk about Harvard, where he went, and the problems it's having right now. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor, editor-at-large of The Spectator, and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. I'm inviting you to join in-depth conversations every week on the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Why was Mike Waltz let go?
So he wasn't let go. He is being made ambassador to the United Nations, which, of course, is a Senate-confirmed position. I think you can make a good argument that it's a promotion. You saw the president announce that Marco Rubio is going to step in as interim leader of the National Security Council. So I think the media wants to frame this as a firing. Donald Trump has fired a lot of people. He doesn't give them Senate-confirmed appointments afterwards. What he thinks is that Mike Waltz is going to better serve the administration, most importantly, the American people in that role, and I happen to agree with him.
Until I talk to him, I won't know, but I want to get Congressman Randy Fine's take. He's now serving in Michael Waltz's district. He won the special election. Congressman, your thoughts on the removal of Michael Waltz and his Senate-confirmed position is going to be the U.N. ambassador.
Well, look, I trust President Trump implicitly to make decisions about who should be advising him on his staff. But I'd note this. Mike Waltz is an American hero. He was a soldier, and he fought for us in the special forces. And I think that's exactly what we could use at the UN, I mean, where he's going to have to deal with people who are literally advancing the terrorist cause. So I think he's going to be fantastic there, and I'm thrilled to see him get that promotion.
I mean, it was at least Stefanik was going to be there. It was going to be a key spot. We saw a lot was made out of it with Nikki Haley. So for you, Congressman, you went to Harvard. 20% of the population you said was Jewish then. Now it's down to like 4 or 5, and it's not a
That's
good
right.
place. They did their own internal study. It's not a place where Jewish Americans or Jews feel comfortable. What can we do about this?
Well, I think we've got to make a change at the top. I mean, I think what we see from most of these institutions is even when they adapt, they're just giving us lip service. Harvard yesterday gave a $65,000 fellowship at the law school to a student who beat up a Jewish kid on campus. That kid should be kicked out of law school, let alone getting a fellowship. The problem we have in many of these higher education institutions is they believe in Muslim terror. They'll say they don't. They'll try to use the words we want to hear. But the fact of the matter is their boards of trustees, their faculty, particularly their liberal arts faculty, they don't like Israel. They don't like Jews. And frankly, they don't like America. And that's what we've got to start to solve.
So they've taken away. Now the president's going to go after their nonprofit status, 501c3 status. I love it. I think he's going after all the funding that they're getting. They are suing to get it back. But the lawyers that they hired, you know better than me, Randy, it seems the lawyers that they hired are looking for some type of settlement. What would you demand if you were to sit down with Harvard?
Well, I would demand they use the IRA definition, which is the leading definition of anti-Semitism in the country. And I'd really push for viewpoint diversity. What's extraordinary about these institutions is they demand diversity in every way we look or sound or feel, but they don't care about diversity in how people think. And I went to Harvard, and what made me the person I am today, frankly, was having to be a conservative 35 years ago, getting the crap kicked out of me by people who didn't agree with me. But it made me tougher. It made me able to defend my views. But I never felt unsafe as a Jewish student. That's the problem. We have gone from bias to safety. And I will tell you, having chaired higher education in Florida for 2 years, where we don't have these problems with our universities, policies are great. It will be money that fixes the problem. You cut off the money and we will make them heal. And that's what we've got to do.
Yeah, the thing is, too, is I want you to hear from Eli Sivis. He was protesters at UCLA, actually stole his flag. Listen to his Jewish flag, Cup 48.
I had my Israeli flag, not to provoke them, but to show, like I always do other Jewish students, that there is no need to be afraid of these protesters. Now, one protester grabbed my flag and ran away.
Right.
I went after them to retrieve my flag, and then around six, seven, eight of them circled around me and started throwing punches. One person tried to put me in a headlock. And right. This shows something, Trace. This shows what we've always known, you and I, for the last year and a half, that these protesters are violent. Anyone who claims that they're peaceful is delusional.
Yeah. So, I mean, your reaction, you didn't have to deal with that, but I can imagine you would have done that if you been confronted with it.
Well, yeah, look, I deal with it every day. I got 5 death threats in my first week in Congress. So that's what happens when you're somebody like me. But what I would say is we're taking this seriously in the U.S. House. Chairman Wahlberg, who runs the Education and Workforce Committee, we're having another hearing on anti-Semitism this week where we're bringing in 3 of these institutions, and we're going to make them answer for the horrific things they're allowing to happen to Jewish American kids on their campuses. It's very simple. Many of these institutions support Muslim terror, and we've got to stand up to them and tell them it's
Congressman
not okay.
Fine, you know who? There's this Jewish guy in Senate. His name goes by Chuck Schumer, who wrote a book about the history and fighting anti-Semitism. Shouldn't he be an ally at this?
He should. And I don't understand how he sleeps at night. I'll be honest with you. I could never be in a caucus with people who hate me. And that is what they have. He is placating people who wish him to go away. I mean, you know, who say all the river to the sea stuff. I don't know how they deal with it. And I think they need to grow a set and they need to take them on. I know I will in Congress.
So in Columbia University, this student, Mohan Madawi, was released from a holding center in Vermont, ICE Center, because they said he was not a threat while they examined what his role was in the anti-Semitic behavior at Columbia University. Well, let me see. His girlfriend, his wife at the time, a gun shop owner, accused him of saying, I used to, where I was, spend a lot of times with this gun killing Jews in Palestine, right? And when he got divorced, his wife got the gun and turned it in just to make sure, I guess, that she wasn't, that you wouldn't use it against her, but he was looked at as nonviolent by a judge.
Yeah, because these judges are trying to fight everything that President Trump is trying to do. Look, in his first term, it was the deep state inside the executive branch. Now it's the deep state in the judicial branch. And we've got to make it clear, if you come here on a visa, student or otherwise, and you're going to hate America, hate Jews, foment violence, we kick you out and we send you home. They are guests in our house. And when you come into my house, I expect you to behave, and that's how our country ought to treat these people.
And by the way, he co-founded the Palestinian Student Union, which is not bad on its surface, but when you team with Mahmoud Khalil and take over a campus and set up pup tents when people should be studying for finals, I have a problem with that. Finally, have you contacted the school, being that you're an alumni?
I have. I've been in contact with them before. It's hard. That Harvard made a kid from Kentucky a successful businessman. I'm incredibly grateful for the education I got 30 years ago. Liberal bias and all. I want Harvard to return to that. We need our institutions to do what they have historically done, not be violence fabrication factories. And so I'll be continuing to work with them and others to get them back on track.
All right, Congressman Randy Fine, I know everyone at WOKB is always happy to hear from you. Thanks so much.
a talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It does feel like something's happening after that meeting with Zelensky in St. Peter's. You posted this on social media. There was no reason for Putin to be shooting missiles into civilian areas and cities and towns over the last few days. It makes me think that maybe...
Well, that was part of my post, but you're right. That was a part of a post.
And
yes.
It says, it makes me think that maybe he doesn't want to stop the war. He's just tapping me along.
Yeah, that's possible. Sure.
He might be...
He could be tapping me along a little bit. I would say that he would like to stop the war. I think that if it weren't for me, I think he'd want to take over the whole country personally.
So that was President of the United States talking to ABC about where we go from here. I have not seen any give at all from Vladimir Putin. Zero. Remember, they were going to do a Black Sea ceasefire. Didn't work. They were going to do an energy ceasefire. I don't think it's been effective. They talked about a ridiculous three-day celebration of winning World War II, ceasefire. They deny they're hitting for civilians. They're aiming civilians. They steal children, torture prisoners, and they don't seem to have any indication that I could tell that they want to find some type of settlement in this war, especially when you look at their demands. But Victoria Coates is the pro. She's a former deputy national security advisor to President Trump and now president of the Catherine and Shelby Colum Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at Heritage. Victoria, welcome back. Your thoughts about what the president said that Vladimir Putin could be up to?
Well, thanks for having me on, Brian. I think, you know, it's very important for everyone to realize that the president is not in any way naive or innocent in this situation. He knows who Putin is, and he knows when he's trying to play him. And so I agree that he's the only thing right now that's standing between Putin and much broader conquest in Ukraine. Hopefully he'll take that seriously. And the other thing for your listeners is the president put out a very strong statement overnight about secondary sanctions on Iranian energy, which means that anybody who buys that energy can be vulnerable to American sanctions. So that's China, you know, that's even India. And so hopefully we would be working with the Indians to, you know, to help them with that and not have them be vulnerable to those sanctions. But at the same time, that could be leveled on Russia. And then you've got some very serious decisions people have to make because Russia is one of the world's big three oil energy producers. So I think the president is signaling that there is additional action he can take if Putin is stringing him along and won't get serious about this.
Absolutely, because obviously Russia is selling a lot of oil to India at a discount rate and to China. So India, China I expected, but India I wasn't. And third-party sanctions to Iran while we're speaking to them, I think it's bold and sends a great message. So let's get back to what we need to bring this war to a close with Ukraine and Russia. Here's what General Keane said the mineral deal does that we signed with Ukraine. Cut 32.
This is really a blow to Putin because everything he's been doing, he's been trying to maneuver the Trump administration away from Ukraine as much as possible. And that's part of his strategic ploy here and the narrative of his playbook that he's been executing. This is significant. This is a generational relationship that the United States has signed into with Ukraine. Obviously, it's economically based, but because of it, it's also politically based, and it has significant security implications. For that to succeed, there has to be stability and security in Ukraine, or else there's not going to be much mining going on if there's a war going on. So there's implications here going forward for security as well, and that is a blow to Russia for certain.
Here's their statement from Medvedev, the former president. Trump has finally broken the Kyiv regime into paying for American aid with minerals. Now military supplies will have to be paid with the national wealth of a disappearing country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty rich coming from Medvedev, who's now, I believe, their deputy national security advisor. You know, they hate this deal because they know it's a good deal for Ukraine. Ukraine competes with Russia for a lot of those natural resources. Quite frankly, I would have liked to see this deal be signed a couple of weeks ago when China came out and said they were limiting their exports of some of these things to us. It would have been great if Ukraine had raised their hand at that point and said, hey, we're here for you, America. We're going to help you. But they got there. And so I think it's a good deal for both. It's a win-win for Ukraine and for the United States and for the American taxpayer. And so I think it's a great model going forward, as well as for reconstruction, how we can help the developing world.
I'm a little concerned that Steve Witkoff goes into these meetings with Vladimir Putin without his own translator, without his own Soviet-Russian team. I don't think anyone, no matter how talented of a negotiator you are, could possibly fully understand what they're up against in there.
Well, you know, that is a concern. It'll be interesting to see who the president decides to put in as the national security advisor. I'd like to see much closer connection between Special Envoy Witkoff's team and the NSC. That was a role I played for, I guess, the second year of the administration when I was tagged to Jason Greenblatt and Jared Kushner's team to make sure they were supported, that they had staff, they had experts, they had background material, people handling their intelligence flow. So I think that can be done. And so, you know, we'll see going forward if they can get them some more support.
Who would you like to see as national security advisor?
Well, there are a lot of really good names out there. You know, I've heard Fred Flights, who was executive secretary of the NSC when I was there. I've heard Elise Stefanik. I've heard my friend Rick Grinnell. These are all great people. And if Elise decides, I mean, I've heard she was going to run for governor of New York, but should be great in this role. The key thing, Brian, is to have somebody in there the president feels very personally comfortable with. It's such a close relationship, much more so than with the cabinet secretaries necessarily. So it has to be a really good personality.
I hear you. Here's what Marco Rubio said, just getting back to Russia, about where we stand with Russia. I'm getting concerned that we're not going to be all in on getting putting an end to this violence, whether it's sanctioning the central bank or arming up Ukraine. Cut 31.
I think we know where Ukraine is and we know where Russia is right now and where Putin is. They're still far apart. They're closer, but they're still far apart. And it's going to take a real breakthrough here very soon to make this possible. Or I think the president is going to have to make a decision about how much more time we're going to dedicate to this. And you're right about the minerals deal. It's good for America because we've invested a lot of money in this war. It's also good for Ukraine because it's going to help them be able to develop their economy and rebuild when this war ends.
So he went on to say, you know, we have so many other things to do. I'm not going to stay here around forever. What do you think would get Russia's attention? Do you think sanctioning the central bank would?
Yes, I do. I think it would be a corollary to what was just done on Iran. I think that is what starts to really shut down their economy. And, you know, Secretary Rubio, now acting National Security Advisor Rubio, the most powerful man since Henry Kissinger, you know, I'm absolutely right here, you know, to say that the president isn't going to waste infinite time. And there are all sorts of things we need to be doing around the world to, you know, project American power, protect American interests. And if, you know, he's not going to just get caught up in an endless cycle of diplomacy for the sake of having talks. I mean, that's what first the Obama administration and then the Biden administration did with the Iranians, is it was just endless talking and nothing was ever really accomplished. So I think really good for both the secretary and the president to signal that this isn't going to go on forever.
So when it comes to Iran talks, they postponed this weekend. We've had 3 weeks, two in Oman, one in Rome. They say they're moving forward, but we're 4-0 in Richmond. Here's what Marco Rubio said about that. Cut 34.
If Iran wants a peaceful civil nuclear program, meaning they want nuclear power plants like other countries in the world have, there's a way to do it. And that is you build the reactors and you import enriched uranium to fuel those reactors. That's how dozens of countries around the world do it. The only countries in the world that enrich uranium are the ones that have nuclear weapons.
So are they going to agree to enrich uranium outside the country? If not, this thing's dead.
It should be dead, Brian. I mean, and you look at a country like UAE, which has put together a very successful civil nuclear program over the last 10 years. And I worked on it a lot my year at DOE, at the Department of Energy. And it's really a model of what this kind of civil nuclear cooperation can be between the United States and countries that will share technology with. And they don't enrich uranium. And that was a key part of their agreement. So I think that's what the Iranians need to agree to at the bare minimum. I, for one, would like to see their civil nuclear program shuttered for a period of time as a good faith gesture, because heaven knows they don't actually need the power that it generates. I don't object to them having one down the road once they've demonstrated some of that good faith. But, I mean, quite frankly, as I said, I'd like to see a pause put on it for the time being.
How long do you think Israel is going to wait?
Well, I just got back last night, and you know this is a topic I've been spending a lot of time thinking about recently. And they're very concerned. The good news is they feel much, much better connected to the Trump administration. They're talking to each other all the time. Obviously, the prime minister and the president are talking. I met with now Ambassador Huckabee, our fantastic representative now, just on the job in Jerusalem. And he's doing a ton of work on this file and just keeping everybody in the loop because, you know, making sure everybody's looking at the same intel, getting the same reports. So if the decision has to be made that a strike is necessary, we're fully lashed up. And I think the key thing they also wanted to convey, Brian, is that they are in no way interested in a regional war. They've spent the last 15, 16 months avoiding a regional war because they don't want it. And in the event a strike is necessary, it can be targeted. It can avoid civilian casualties, which I know is something the president's concerned with. And they've done this before. They did it in Iraq and they did it in Syria, and there was no war. So the folks who are running around saying any strike immediately leads to World War III, I just don't think they're studying their history.
I hear you. We probably have the bombs that would be the most effective to shut down these multiple facilities. And I don't know how much longer they're going to be vulnerable. And Israel's the one responsible for making them vulnerable. Victoria, do you get the sense of any with Gaza that there's an end game close?
Well, we talked about that a lot. To your last point, you know, yes, every day that goes by means the Iranians are rebuilding their capacity. And that's why the delay in the technical talks that were supposed to start under Michael Anton is concerning because they're using each of those days. For Gaza, you know, it's a really painful, grinding situation. We still have the hostages, including the American and then four American deceased hostages as well, unfortunately, that, you know, that you just got to get them out. They have to give them back. And I think we should be putting all pressure on Hamas to do that. And, you know, if Hamas is accurate that the Israeli pause in humanitarian aid is becoming a crisis for them, they've claimed this a lot. So I have some skepticism there. But Hamas can end this tomorrow. They are the ones who are in charge of who eats in Gaza. So if they're starting to feel that pressure, hopefully they will lay down their arms, agree to stop attacking Israel, and we can get to that day after everyone wants to talk about.
All right. She's the author of The Battle for the Jewish State, How Israel and America Can Win. Victoria Coates, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
All right. When we come back, we'll take your calls. First time, 1-866-408-7669. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot on our plate. Are you feeling better about the economy this week than last week, judging by the job numbers that just came in, way over predictions? Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade.
If Democrats think that at this particular point, just because Donald Trump is unpopular, that they're going to run away with it like a Heisman Trophy winner, that is not necessarily the case. These numbers should be a major wake-up call for Democrats. Despite Donald Trump's unpopularity in the polls, when you actually go up against him and you put Democrats' names against him, when you put Republicans as a whole up against him, Republicans and Donald Trump do considerably better. And that is why Democrats, in fact, cannot count their chickens just yet, because those eggs have not cracked at this particular moment.
And that is the CNN pollster who said, yeah, these numbers for 100 days, the CNN polls don't look good for Trump, but against any Democrat, Trump still wins. And that's the point, isn't it? So you come out, I'm against Trump, I'm this, and he's terrible, and he's going to threaten democracy. I thought it was interesting, too, is that Anderson Cooper was interviewing the senator from Connecticut. And he comes out and says, well, Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. He goes, well, Senator, didn't you try that already? It didn't work. He got elected. He's not a threat. No one thinks he's a threat to democracy. Well, if I stop saying it, it doesn't. I'm not helping our country. They have to sooner or later, they'll realize it. He's not a threat to democracy. He's trying to be president. He's trying to get his things across. You know what's stopping him? The courts, not Democrats. They don't have any counter argument. So I think right now, too. You know, the 100 days on that mark, the economy on the actual 100th day, the economy was 0.3%. Then when the more you looked at it, it's not nearly as bad as everyone thought. Then the job numbers come in strong. And now, all of a sudden, at day 102, the market's now over 41,000, up 400 points today. So Trump is fully believes that as more and more deals come in, he's going to reconfigure our trade relationships with the entire country, bring manufacturing back. And I also think in the Trump style, we have to get the rare earth back in America. We have to get can't purchase it out of China. No more magnets from China. If there's 95% of the magnets are in China, I find that hard to believe. There's not the same material at any other place on the planet Earth. It makes no sense to me. So here's the other thing the president has. They think she can get the economy going is the big, beautiful bill. The parameters he put on his party to get this done with no Democratic support are severe. No tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on Social Security. He says get it done, but still cut the budget as well as increase the Pentagon budget. Cut four.
These will be the biggest tax cuts in American history with 100% expensing, which is something that people cannot believe they're getting. We did it in the last one, and we had the most successful economy in my first 4 years that we've ever had, the history of our country. And expensing was one of the things that led to that. But it's 100% expensing for companies investing in America and increasing take-home pay for the typical family by thousands of dollars a year to show you how middle income this is. There'll be no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax for the great seniors in Social Security. So you have no tax on Social Security for our great seniors. And we have a full deduction for interest. If you buy a car that's made in America, you get an interest rate deduction. That's going to be a big, it's got to be made in America. If it's not made in America, we really don't care if you buy it or not.
But right now they give it 25% in exemption on the auto manufacturers, because even if you're a place like Ford and most of the car is built here, some of it is still outside the country and you got to bring it in and bring in some parts. So if they're tariffed, it's going to affect the price of assembly. And if the effects of the price of assembly, it cuts into small margins. So they try to give an exemption there on the car companies. And as J.D. Vance really went into detail with Brett last night, he said, you know, the car industry is about to evaporate if we don't do something. Because people are coming in with, you know, lower labor costs, these electric cars, like the Chinese come in with this electric car at extremely low labor costs. They stole most of the technology to begin with. They have the rare earth. So we would really, if we do not do something to open up the markets of India and Europe to American cars, Ford, GM, and Stellantis, Chrysler, are really going to suffer. And that is why I believe the car companies have been somewhat compliant and quiet, because the goal is not to hurt them. I mean, that's 2008. They were looked as part of being the culprits of this, of the collapse of the economy. And it's not the case now. I think people understand, just like the farmers, you play an important role. We want to see people work with you. And this president is not at war with unions. He likes to make it work when it can. And that's why unions backed Liberation Day, one of the few groups to come forward and say, love what you do and love the objective. Let's get it done. So get it done.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, but we're looking around the world and around the country. Bottom of the hour, Mike Lawler is going to be with us. Is he queuing up for Republican to get the Republican nomination and run for governor? What about Elise Stefanik? Would that affect anything? We'll discuss that with him, along with the big, beautiful bill. And Olivia Rheingold's in studio, staff writer at the Free Press. And we're going to get to her shortly. Just AOC is having a big event tonight. Why does that matter? I think she's become a national figure. People are looking at her for 2028, and she wants a key a party chairmanship or ranking membership over at the Oversight Committee. We'll see how that goes. And the President of the United States is going to be speaking, too. So before we get to Olivia, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's been 50 days. 50 days of pain and suffering. My children and I had to watch Trump and Bukele's administration laugh over pain.
Right. She is also in pain because she was beaten twice by the illegal immigrant boyfriend, I guess she had, It's illegal immigrant madness. More details of that monster, Kilmar Albergo Garcia, and what he did before he was shipped out to El Salvador. We'll discuss it.
Number two.
Why was Mike Wallace let go?
So he wasn't let go. He is being made ambassador to the United Nations, which, of course, is a Senate-confirmed position. I think you can make a good argument that it's a promotion.
Yep. Shake up at 1600. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz exit for the UN. Marco Rubio fills in. What does it mean for Russia, Ukraine, Iran, and Israel? We'll discuss it.
Number one.
A lot of people like to talk about tariffs. Well, tariffs is exactly what they were doing for us. You know, when you want to defend that, they're a beautiful thing for us. If you can use them, if you can get away with using them, it's going to make us very rich.
Well, that is President Trump speaking yesterday on the economy, on tariffs. Are we going to begin to start talking with China? The New York Times has a story today where there's been an overture made. China's got to consider with parameters to begin talking at any level. We're going to look at the tariffs, the president's budget, and the latest on the big, beautiful bill. 19 Republicans have already put out a letter warning President Trump, you have to cut Medicaid. That's going to be trouble. Olivia Rheingold joins us now for the Free Press. Olivia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
A lot going on in New York and around the country. First off, when you talk about what's happening in New York, the president's had a lot of focus on Columbia, Harvard, mm-hmm. and Yale. Mm-hmm. What's going on these college campuses? You told me you went to journalism school at Columbia.
I did,
bring us onto the campus when you went there and tell me how it might have changed now.
Yeah, so when I went there, there were definitely hints of what was to come, where I remember at least once I had a pitch shot down because it was considered racist. Honestly, it's a little complicated to get into, but I think it was racist that they considered it racist.
Yes.
Definitely over abortion. I mean, they considered the job of a reporter, especially when it comes to abortion, to expose the corruption of the pro-life movement. So it's very easy to see where the social justice roots come in. I went there pre-BLM, and from what I've heard of from students who have gone there after BLM, I mean, in my head, I call it the Columbia School of Propaganda, because I think it really is to train the next generation of journalists how to help progressive movements and make liberal cases through reporting.
So this guy, this student, Moshan Madawi,
right,
who is a co-founder of a Palestinian group on campus mm-hmm. that helped lead the takeover of the encampments and everything else like that, was let go of, out of an ICE facility in Vermont. They said he's not a danger. However, they do have a gun store owner who says that he told him that he used his gun to kill Jews.
Right.
Seems to me that's a danger. In fact, when he broke up with his wife, she turned in his gun because she was concerned about her welfare. These are two incidents that you would think a judge would say, hey, listen, until we determine your legal status, we should probably hold on to you.
So, okay, those instances are news to me. What I can say is that I did embed within the Columbia encampment. I probably spent, 4 or 5 days there, sometimes blending in as a student. And I saw an interview in which that student was really shocked by the descriptions of the encampment being anti-Semitic, and it absolutely was. I mean, really what they stood for was a sanitized, westernized version of the actual Hamas doctrine. It's very hard to distinguish where Hamas's ideology begins and where a lot of the ideas that were floating around that encampment stood for. So, the student, personally, I am conflicted about what should happen regarding his immigration status, but I mean, it's clear as day. The group is extremely radical and anti-Israel.
Right. And Columbia started it, and they let their $400 million frozen. And they said, okay, what do we need to do to get that money unfrozen? Trump is saying, we're going to look at everything, including your curriculum. They don't know how to handle that. This is an all out. This is an attempt to straighten this whole thing out. The poison ivy poor part of America.
Right. And I mean, personally, I'm also conflicted on this.
Should the government be telling you what's
going on? Really an aggressive and a slippery slope. But at the same time, I mean, next semester, there are already classes slated on settler colonialism that use Israel as an example. And so I'm not quite sure how you get the rot out. I'd like to think that you get the rot out just by open debate and exchange of ideas, but anyone suggesting that Israel has simply the right to exist is shut down on
campus.
It was campus.
They said they called themselves the Gaza Solidarity Encampment.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you, when the Iranians come out and thank you, and when Hamas right. comes out and thanks the students in right. America, isn't that pretty? Isn't that telling?
I mean, to that. Here's the thing. I think they are so confused that they actually might think that that's a plus for them. I mean, when you speak to a lot of these students, I'm not sure if they would even, I think they outright support the Iranian regime at this point, to be honest.
Now think about that. What education could you possibly have? The people of Iran hate their regime. But
so
we here
wild.
In America,
yeah. Yeah.
Like the Grand Ayatollah, if you're a woman, do you think you'd thrive in Iran?
Right.
Do you think any of these women
right.
would thrive?
Right.
I'm
right.
so tired of having rights and freedom to speak
right.
and pick out my own outfits.
Right, right. And I mean, women is one thing, but when I was walking along the encampment, there were tons of signs. Queer starts with an F for Palestine. You know, a lot of trans support for Palestine. I have no idea what their conception.
Because you know how they feel about homosexuality.
Yeah, yeah. Like we were talking about the pitch that it was racist, that they thought it was racist. I think that this is think that the Palestinians only believe or are only anti-LGBTQ because of Western oppression or something like that, instead of it being a sincere belief.
Right.
It's so confusing.
They're trying to give them a bailout for their archaic beliefs about human sexuality, when in turn, if you were gay, they would say, what roof do you want us to throw you
yeah,
off of?
Exactly.
So we'll see what happens. And as I mentioned before, Professor McWhorter was sitting in your seat.
Right.
He's very well-known author and professor
yeah.
at Columbia.
Yeah.
And he said that he believes the majority of the faculty think Israel was a huge mistake. And they got the job, and they're teaching elite students
mm-hmm.
that you need to get fantastic mm-hmm. grades in order to be an undergrad. They're looking at the foreign students, why they're chosen, what the school is getting from other countries. This is long overdue, but it's being hit. Harvard is being hit extremely hard. They're suing back. And Yale, last Wednesday,
right.
with all this
right.
scrutiny, still could not control their student body who came out against who came out for anti-Semitism.
Yeah, yeah. On Yale, they were shouting "Glory to our martyrs," which is so bizarre. And most of the kids that I've met who are chanting this stuff, they're on Zoloft, they're using Daddy's credit card, and yet they are basically shouting "Allahu Akbar" in the streets.
It's crazy. So you would think you're dealing with a naive culture of like the Bowery Boys, the uneducated without parents living in an orphanage. But you're talking about kids highly educated
right.
with a lot of options who get into an elite school, and their choice to go with that barbaric way of thinking is insane. Did they even read about 9/11?
That's a whole nother thing, because I think that there's a lot of 9/11 revisionism. But I think that it is two things. I think it's a lack of skepticism. I think that if you are presented a sanitized, westernized version of the Hamas doctrine, I think that professors, like we were just talking about, have found a compelling way to frame it in a social justice narrative. But these students, they lack the skepticism to even go and Google the counter arguments. So I will be sympathetic in that regard, that if you are that some of these arguments are highly persuasive, especially if it's framed as a, you know, evil white people against brown minorities type thing, which is an argument that they are very open to. The other thing is, obviously, there's so much social clout to believing these things. And when I was on when I was in the encampment, it did kind of make sense that for a generation stunted by the pandemic, I mean, this was fun. It's a chance to connect for them, to paint their nails for Palestine, to chat with friends. And so it's also a point of social connection, I think, is what's driving it.
The Al-Qaeda color scheme wasn't attractive.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not sure. All right, let's talk about just real quick, because it's another area you've dealt with, PBS and NPR,
right.
President of the United States, in an executive order is denying them all funds. Now, of course, they'll sue back. You work there. Is he right to do this? Is he right to feel as though both those organizations, instead of being unbiased, are biased against Republicans and him?
Yeah, I mean, I don't blame him. The first thing to note is that it really is a very small proportion of their funding, that NPR. I think it's about 1% of their budget comes from federal funds. So it really is a symbolic gesture to take that funding away. But I don't blame him, because I think that NPR at its best a few decades ago probably really was a public service. It's gotten really far away from that, where I don't think you can argue this is in the public good. I think if you're a blue-haired lady driving a Subaru on your way to, like, I don't know, volunteer at Planned Parenthood, you probably think it's in the public good. But it's become a really partisan institution that, you know, inserted words and framing I wasn't comfortable in my reporting.
You had some problems
Trump.
When you were there.
Yeah, yeah. There was one story I did that was picked up nationally by NPR where it was about Trump's tweets, one of Trump's tweets. And I spoke to local Montanans, because I lived in Montana at the time, and no one I spoke to thought that these tweets were racist. And yet, when I saw what the NPR, the national editors, had done to my story, the headline they gave it had the word racist in the tweets. I think Trump is not wrong to consider it a hotbed of propaganda.
In New York, you're also covering this Luigi Mangione situation. We watched him in cold blood shoot the CEO. By the way, no problem with the CEO. He has no history with him. Just stalked him and killed him. Ran.
Right.
Planned it, plotted it.
Right.
So he's looking at the death penalty. He wants to get rid of state charges, federal charges. But not only is he not vilified, he is lauded. And
they even
do in a play about Mangione.
Yeah.
Could you tell me about
this?
Well,
first of all, not a play. It's a musical. They've got some musical.
They're singing
about him. And it's inspired, musically, it's inspired by the show Chicago. Which is has a little va-va-voom energy to it, because, you know, Luigi is considered a sex symbol, honestly. And the makers of the musical have really been careful to say we're not valorizing Luigi Mangione. But I read this quote one of them gave where he said, OMG, it is so campy, the whole good guy with a gun thing. I don't know what they're talking. This is not the Met Gala. This is not. You know, they were talking about it as if this is like a episode of RuPaul's Drag Race or something, as if it weren't a murder.
It was an assassination, right?
Yeah.
And you also, in the same prison in New York,
right.
P. Diddy, who goes on trial on Monday, as well as Sam Bankman-Fried.
Yeah, they appear.
So they
in the
all appear in the musical.
Yeah, and it's I think the term might be gender diverse casting, where, you know, they've got a woman. I think women. I'm sorry, don't mean to gender this person. It's potentially a they them is playing Sam Bankman-Fried. But yeah, gender diverse casting.
We used to call that Pat. Remember Pat on SNL? No one could figure out
sorry.
If Pat was a man or a woman.
Oh, okay.
It was a character. Now it would be
They're
politically incorrect
that.
To do it. I'm sure they're going to apologize it at some point. So you don't know what to make of it, but you can't get a ticket.
Oh, I can't get a ticket. No, I tried because I want to see it. I want to see it. But yeah, I've been, embedded with his supporters. I'm a member of the Discord group. I like to check in, see what's going on there. He's got a lot of fans.
Real good. Real quick. Olivia, you are working on What for the Free Press after this.
I'm actually going to that AOC rally tomorrow in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
So another one. So she's got one year in New York with Jackson Heights tonight. Yeah, I guess so.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know she's
And then she's
going
to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Is that the oligarchy tour?
Fighting the oligarchy.
Fighting the oligarchy.
Bernie Sanders, yeah.
We'll find out. Can Democrats figure out what oligarchy means? Because there's a school of thought from the Senator Slotkin of Michigan. Don't use the word oligarchy. No one knows what it means.
To be honest, I don't even really understand what they're trying to do with that.
I don't either.
I think that's going to be my question when I go there is, do you guys know what this means?
Right.
Yeah.
Because some rich people are volunteering to work with Trump. They used to like say they're all volunteer. David Sachs.
Right.
Elon Musk.
Right.
And
right.
some others.
Right. And yet they're flying private everywhere.
You got to get, like John Kerry says, you got to be, this is the only way for me to travel.
Right. Right.
And for you too, Olivia, I encourage you to tell Free Press. They'll reimburse
Gotta fly
you.
Private there.
Yeah, they'll reimburse you, I'm sure. Olivia Rheingold, thanks so much. Great to meet you. Hope we do this again.
Yeah, good to meet you too.
Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Do you think more of your Democratic colleagues should be traveling to El Salvador to advocate on behalf of Abednego Garcia?
I think you should
off. Yeah, that's
I'm sorry, what, Congresswoman? Who should?
You.
Why me?
We're not taking any questions right now, but here you go.
Yeah, thanks.
And that is, I know what I loved? That he heard it the first time. He made her repeat it. And then he acted like he was, it was instructions. He couldn't figure it out. But why should I? Why should I do that? I'm only asking you why you idiots in the Democratic Party want to go after Kilmer Albargo Garcia, who beat his wife twice, was called by the gang unit a member of MS-13, and told the judge, I can't go back to El Salvador because I'm afraid of a rival gang. He was deported by ICE, and the only reason why there's any problem was that they said don't send him in El Salvador because of rival gang issues. Well, they both, one has been destroyed and the other one's been arrested. So for you to keep going, and by the way, it's getting really embarrassing for everybody because now we have the video when he was pulled over by a cop with seven people in the car with no luggage, and the cop looks at the camera, the body, and says, this is human trafficking. Guess who was driving? Garcia. Guess who knew English and couldn't find his license or registration with somebody else's car? Garcia.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I want to let you know what I was just doing in a really great meeting with Speaker Johnson. We heard also Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Chairman Brett Guthrie, who's a fantastic guy, and Chairman Smith. Everybody knows Chairman Smith. He's the most knowledgeable person on taxes and finances there is. To be updated on the progress of the one big, beautiful bill. We love that bill. I won't like it if it doesn't pass. Neither will you. If it doesn't pass, your taxes are going to go up 68%. So think of it, 68. And this is a religious ceremony to me, but that's part of the religion. Because if your taxes go up 68%, you might give up your religion. You might have no choice. You'll be working too hard to try and make it. And that's the Democrats. That's what they'll give you. They'll vote against it. It's not even believable. It's called Trump derangement syndrome.
So the president of the United States is moving on a bunch of fronts. He got good news on the job number. Well, America got good news. We had 177,000 jobs. Experts predicted 152 would be great. So it's like 49,000 above what they thought. So people have speculated, even people of negative people like Mark Zandi, he said, if it's 150, the economy's fine. And it is. So the markets respond. It's almost up 500 points. We're well over 41,000. At the same time, there's some movement with China. There's some parameters being laid out where we would begin talks. Clearly, some indications that even we can get out of that suffocating country, that they are really hurting. And the EU pushing back on dumping all this material there that they can't sell to us has really helped us and strengthened our bargaining position. At the same time, moving is Congress on a big, beautiful bill that they have nicknamed it, that is supposed to extend the tax cuts and do more and be passed by the House, maybe before Memorial Day. And then we'll see what happens in reconciliation with the Senate. But there's some non-starters, one of which is SALT, which means you get off for state tax, get tax breaks for state taxes, is not included. There's a lot of people in blue states, Republicans in blue states, who won't sign on to it. One of which is Congressman Mike Lawler of New York, 17th District. Congressman, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Congressman, so I'm sure you know that Chip Roy put a letter out there signed by 19 others. Lawmakers said that the GOP conference must pursue meaningful reforms and reconciliation, including eliminating the enhanced federal matching funds for states and expanded Medicaid. I mean, that's his Waterloo. You got yours with SALT. How are you gonna just find a way forward with all these differing agendas?
Well, look, this is democracy, right? This is why we have a constitutional republic. You have 435 members in the Republican Conference, 220, and we're going to have to duke it out and negotiate and come to consensus. None of us are going to get everything we want out of this, but there's going to have to be a give and a take. And, you know, ultimately, you know, on the issue of Medicaid, I've been clear. I have no problem with eligibility verification, citizenship verification, work requirements. But when you start talking about changing the FMAP floor, changing the federal share, you are going to undoubtedly impact people who are, in fact, eligible. And that I do not support. And I've been very clear about that with leadership. I've been very clear about that with the White House. And by the way, the president agrees with us. He does not want to be kicking people off Medicaid. This is a vital lifeline for folks. When you look at our total federal spend over the next 10 years, we're projected to spend $86 trillion. We are talking about upwards of $1.5 trillion in savings. That's about 1.7% of the total federal spend over these 10 years. The question is how do you get there? How do you, what programs are you willing to look at? What changes are you willing to make? And whatever that number ends up being that can get 218 votes, that's what the number will be. But in the absence of that, if you can't get 218 votes, you're not going to have a bill. And so to me, this is, you know, everybody's going to have to negotiate in good faith. When it comes to the issue of SALT, I've been very clear that this is a red line for me. There has to be a fix. Leaving the cap at 10,000 is unacceptable.
Well, was it zero, right?
Well, no, it was unlimited. It was unlimited prior to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and you were able to fully deduct your state and local taxes.
No, I know, but before that, didn't they originally pass in and have zero break for state and local taxes?
Oh, they were originally pushing for zero, yes.
Yeah.
But again, this was a pay-for, Brian. This was a pay-for for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. They needed to find funding to pay for other provisions, so they decided to cap your ability to deduct your state and local taxes. They doubled the standard deduction, and for many people, that was sufficient. It helped cover them. But for a lot, especially in areas like mine or where you live out on Long Island, it most assuredly did not cover, because we have high property taxes, a high cost of living, and folks can say, oh, well, that's just bad blue state policies and stop voting for Democrats. Well, agree, stop voting for Democrats in blue states that want to tax and spend. But the fact is, if you look at a state like South Carolina, a great red state that everybody loves to put up on a pedestal, they get more money from the federal government than tax revenue they send to the federal government. New York is the reverse. New York sends more money to the federal government through taxes than we get back in services from the federal government. So we are a donor state. So this idea of, oh, these bad blue states, I don't want to subsidize them. Well, if we want to start talking about subsidies, then we can start pulling federal dollars from states that don't send tax revenue to the federal government.
So let me ask you this. You're the expert in this area. When Obamacare passes, he offers states grants to expand their Medicaid eligibility. And it's almost like sending out heroin. They go, really? So I could expand it, get federal money, and expand the amount of people eligible for Medicaid. And in a way, Medicaid has outstripped what it was intended to do. It's supposed to be state aid for those in need. With federal aid coming in, did it expand the eligibility to an unsustainable way?
Oh, there's no question. The Medicaid program has exploded in terms of cost. And if you look at a state like New York, they spend 83% more than the average of the other 49 states. So New York needs to get its Medicaid program under control. It's not sustainable long term to continue to spend at the levels that New York does. They
right.
just proposed a $254 billion budget. But if the federal government, which whether we like it or not, Obamacare passed and it did not get repealed. And so a lot of people over the last
are counting on
years,
it. Yeah.
Are counting on it. And so you would be taking away health care from individuals who rely on this vital service.
Mike, could you say, could you say this to the states? Pay for yourself. Keep the same people, but find a way to pay for it yourself, because that was somebody else's policies. It's not mine. It's state aid. Pay for it from your own coffers.
Well, the problem with the expansion population, the federal government is paying 90% of the share. So that would be a massive cost shift onto the states. And again, New York relies on, I think, about $90 billion in federal aid. It would be a significant shift to do in one fell swoop to say we're cutting off your federal aid. That just will not work. Are there reforms that need to take place? Of course. Of course, the whole healthcare system is out of whack. You look at what Obamacare was intended to do. It was intended to do two things: address access and affordability. On the issue of access, obviously, by expanding out Medicaid and putting the requirements on states, obviously you expand access. But the cost of it has exploded. I'm not in disagreement that there needs to be changes. But the question to me here, if you are going to change the FMAP share, the federal share of Medicaid, you are shifting the cost onto the states, which, by the way, means our property taxes are going to go up, which is all the more reason that you need SALT relief. New York is the only state left in the country that requires the counties to pay a quarter of the cost of Medicaid. So we, Brian, you, me, those of us living in New York would get absolutely hammered in our property taxes to pay for that cost share. I'm not willing to do that. I'm just not willing to do that.
So talking to Michael Lawler about the big, beautiful bill and how Republicans negotiating with each other. We're not talking about Democrats. We're talking about the Republicans with Republicans.
Yeah, this is a Republican negotiation.
Yeah. So Congressman, if you're Trump, right, he's obviously a New Yorker. He understands. He gets it. But he has to find savings, because at the same time, he also committed to no tax on tips, no taxes on Social Security. So where would you recommend he find the savings and the cuts?
Look, this is in part what the Department of Government Efficiency is going through. This is in part what Congress is going through with fiscal year 26 appropriations and a rescissions package and, of course, the reconciliation bill. Each committee is going through that work right now. I'm on financial services. We were tasked with finding $1 billion in savings. We found $5 billion in savings. We passed that markup, that piece of the reconciliation bill through committee this week. Each committee is going through that work. The big fight is on the issue of Medicaid. And I have outlaid where I am willing to go with it. The eligibility verification, citizenship verification, work requirements. That will add up to somewhere to the tune of roughly $400 billion, plus any of the energy issues that the Energy and Commerce Committee is right. focused on. You know, all of this adds up. The question will be to what number? And for my, colleagues in the Freedom Caucus, are they really going to take the position that they would rather zero cuts and no bill versus, say, $400 billion because it's not $800 billion? I mean, that's foolish. The question is, what can you get 218 votes on? And that ultimately relies on every member going and making a determination on the impacts on their district, on their state, on their communities. And again, the president has been clear, by the way, he does not want to cut Medicaid benefits from anybody. He does not want to take away people's health care. He has said that repeatedly.
Right. I know, but the endemic problems within it. And nobody wants to, if you're making $22,000 a year and you want to go to the doctor and you have a kid that needs help, nobody says, okay, let's screw them. Nobody wants that. They're just trying to see the social programs, how they make it.
But if you go after the expansion population in that way, you are. And that's why I've said I'm not.
Well, before Obamacare, how were they being taken care of?
Well, if they didn't have health care, they were going to the emergency rooms. And by the way, that's what you'll get again. You'll get people going back to the emergency rooms And that's not going to solve anything. So, look, health care as a whole, putting this reconciliation bill aside, I think we can all agree the health care system 15 years after Obamacare is completely out of whack. The cost has not come down. It has gone up astronomically. We have a shortage of doctors, nurses, home health aides. People are leaving. You need tort reform in the system. So there's a lot that needs to be done. We need PBM reform, which would reform the prescription drug costs challenge that we deal with in this country. And I think there's a broad openness to doing that, but that can't be done in the reconciliation bill. And so to just cut people off of Medicaid would be foolish. It would be totally foolish. And by the way, Republicans will lose big in the midterms if that's what happens.
Especially in the states, in states like the blue states, where people like you win the purple districts. So, Congressman Mike Lawler, do you want to be Governor Mike Lawler? When are you going to make a decision?
I'll make a decision sometime in June. We're looking at it right now. We're having an analysis done of the state and the voter file and making a determination of whether or not there's really a pathway. Delvin did well, but he still lost by 350,000 votes. So you gotta figure out what the pathway is on paper, and then I'll make a decision. New York needs change. There's no question about it. Kathy Hochul is the worst governor in America. She has failed. She's feckless. She's incompetent. And if we don't have change, this state is headed for disaster.
So if Elise Stefanik runs, will that affect your decision?
It's not going to change my decision. I'll make a decision solely based on whether or not I think I can win a general election, and we'll take it from there. Obviously, she's going through her process. We'll all make a determination. The bottom line is, this is not about winning a primary. It's about winning a general election and defeating Kathy Hochul. And that's mm-hmm. got to be the focus for all of us.
Congressman Mike Lowe, before you go, as you know, Michael Waltz has moved on. He's going to be in the U.N. We don't know exactly why he's moved on. Of course, we hear rumors and stories. Here's what Akeem Jeffries says. Cut 12.
The whole notion that the Trump administration was based on merit, as explained by, I forget the guy's name who spoke earlier today, so random. But the Trump administration is the most incompetent administration ever assembled, particularly as it relates to the defense and national security apparatus.
Your thoughts about his description of the people running the country?
Tell that to the 13 families, Gold Star families, of those soldiers who were killed in Afghanistan thanks to the gross incompetence of the Biden administration. The world is in the most precarious place since the lead up to World War II because of Joe Biden's foreign policy, the disaster that was Antony Blinken at the State Department, Lloyd Austin at the Defense Department. This administration is tasked with cleaning up the messes that were left behind, taking on the illicit oil trade between China and Iran that exploded to the tune of $200 billion. That's what funded Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. So we are cleaning up the mess. I think the administration is progressing when it comes to foreign policy and taking on the rogue states and bad actors and trying to end these conflicts around the globe.
Michael Lawler, a lot of decisions, but you're right in the thick of things. Hopefully we'll get something before Memorial Day. Congressman Mike Lawler, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
These programs, these grants are going to be like along the lines of Save the Baby Pandas. And it's like, well, of course, who wouldn't want to save the baby pandas?
I wish I knew how this pandamania started.
You know, in some cases, they've got a show panda, which they will trot out for special occasions. In a lot of cases, they don't even have a show panda.
No panda.
There's not even one panda.
But my entire lifetime, we've been fascinated with pandas.
What does $1 billion get you? Does it not even get you one panda?
You really want to see a baby panda?
Yeah.
I have no interest in pandas.
So Eric just put that together because I'm befuddled that pandas are such a big deal. And last night with Jesse, Elon Musk was focused on panda investment, right?
He said, who wouldn't care about a baby panda? I'm like, clearly they haven't followed your career.
John listening on the Fox News Radio app in California. Hey, John.
Hey, Brian. Good morning, Brian. Hey, I just want to, we were talking about the economy and
yes.
what I noticed. I just left the Iron Curtain of California for a couple weeks and visited to North Carolina and South Carolina. Gas, $2.25 a gallon. People in the bars, people in the restaurants. It's like, I think Washington and the coastal people are in their own little world.
I think so, too. But
from high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Everyone, glad you're there. Thanks for being with us all week long. It's going to be a big hour. Tommy Lahren, bottom of the hour. Shannon Bream, anchor of Fox News Sunday, standing by. A lot going on. We know AOC's got a big event tonight. Tomorrow she'll be in Pennsylvania. Why? It looks like she's emerging as the leader of the Democratic Party. I know Crockett says this is her time. And Bernie Sanders thinks that these crowds are there for him. So he is getting some pretty big crowds. Meanwhile, Donald Trump last night delivered the Alabama commencement speech, and he seemed to have a great time. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's been 50 days. 50 days of pain and suffering. My children and I had to watch Trump and Bukele's administration laugh over pain.
That is Jennifer Vasquez, whose boyfriend, or I don't know, husband, Kilmar Albergo Garcia, is still in El Salvador. He only beat her up twice that we know of, and I'm being sarcastic, as well as being caught on camera, which seems to be human trafficking, as well as being caught with gangsters. But we have to spend all our time trying to get him back to freedom. Meanwhile, the courts are continuing to stand in the way of President Trump getting rid of illegal alien criminals. We'll discuss.
Number two.
Why was Mike Wallace let go?
So he wasn't let go. He is being made ambassador to the United Nations, which, of course, is a Senate-confirmed position. I think you can make a good argument that it's a promotion.
Vance weighs in. The shakeup at 1600. National Security Advisor Mike Wallace exit for the UN. Rubio fills in. What does it mean for Russia, Ukraine, Iran, and Israel? We'll examine.
Number one.
A lot of people like to talk about tariffs. Well, tariffs is exactly what they were doing for us. You know, when you want to defend that, they're a beautiful thing for us. If you can use them, if you can get away with using them, it's going to make us very rich.
And right now we are getting revenue in and the economy's picking up. We'll see. Is there a deal with China beginning? Both sides look like they want to talk. We're going to look at the tariffs, the president's budget, skinny budget, and the latest on the big, beautiful bill. I will say this. About 2 hours ago, we got word of the jobs report. Supposed to be about 130, ends up 177, well over what they projected. Gas has dropped below $2. Prices, inflation has slowed marginally. But the problem is people want certainty. The market seems really happy right now. It's all in the green, up 446 points, over 41,000. So we'll see what other momentum they can build today. Shannon Bream, anchor of Fox News Sunday. Shannon, welcome back.
What are you doing, Brian?
What am I doing?
Yeah.
I'm sitting in my studio.
You're a busy man. I feel like in one of the 50 jobs that you have, I feel like I'd have to check on you and see how you're doing.
Oh, how am I doing? I'm doing great.
Good.
I mean, a myriad of issues today. I mean, at first, what one of the big stories in the New York Times is it looks like the U.S. and China are making overtures on what they would need to start mm-hmm. talking. That would be something the markets would welcome. President Trump reportedly says, let's just me and President Xi talk. China mm-hmm. says, we are so unpredictable. I don't think we should put our guy in with your guy, but both parties need each other economically, but they want to mm-hmm. rebalance the relationship, or at least we do.
Yeah, and that's what President Trump has said all along. He doesn't want unfair trade. He's all for fair trade. He wants these things to get going. But, you know, the soundbite that you played there leading in, where he talks about the fact, like, there have been tariffs on us and our stuff, and they're very high by a lot of other countries. Why hasn't anybody done anything about that? Although he admits there's going to be some pain in the process, he's really hoping and believing that long-term it will pay off. People are rattled right now. But like you said, if these deals start to come in, it's going to give the markets that stability they crave.
Yeah, so far, this is the story in the Times today. The quote from the Chinese says, if the United States does not correct its wrong unilateral tariff measures, it means the United States has no sincerity at all and will further damage the mutual trust between the two sides. So I guess she's indicating. And what he says is drop the tariffs and we'll talk. Now, to zero, never going to happen. But I could see him dropping from 145 to 110 and then beginning to talk about how to attack the $300 billion surplus that the Chinese have, because they're hurting on manufacturing. They have unemployment problems. Their housing, they have a housing crisis that's lasted 2 years. Their consumer confidence is in the toilet. So they have huge issues.
They do, and that's just reality. We know that about their economy. Now, they're going to want to posture that things are good, and that's the language you're going to hear from the top on down. But you're right. There could be movement on these tariffs. The president has done that with other countries, and he's paused a lot of this stuff, and people are still at the table and negotiating because they know what's coming if they don't. But there is room, because the U.S. and China have ratcheted up our tariffs back and forth so high, it does leave room to say, like, all right, let's take this off ramp. Let's, you know, back off 25% here, 10% there. And there have been exceptions to some really critical products as well. So I think that, you know, you start in an extreme position. The president always does this. That's what you do in negotiations. Hoping you get somewhere back towards the middle.
So, Shannon, yesterday, the big news yesterday happened during the middle of this show, that Michael Waltz will be stepping out. 2 hours later, got a new job. He's going to get, he's nominated to be the UN ambassador. It's going to be Senate confirmed. There'll probably be a lot of fireworks. J.D. Vance says it's a promotion. Cut 10.
Why was Mike Waltz let go?
So he wasn't let go. He is being made ambassador to the United Nations, which, of course, is a Senate-confirmed position. I think you can make a good argument that it's a promotion. You saw the president announce that Marco Rubio is going to step in as interim leader of the National Security Council. So I think the media wants to frame this as a firing. Donald Trump has fired a lot of people. He doesn't give them Senate-confirmed appointments afterwards. What he thinks is that Mike Waltz is going to better serve the administration, most importantly, the American people in that role, and I happen to agree with him.
All right. And he went on to say that he's did some reforms. Time for him to move on. What do your sources say really happened?
Well, there has been some daylight between the president and Mike Waltz on a few things. I think when you look at Ukraine and Iran, there have been some minor differences. You know, the reporting is, and the scuttlebutt here in Washington is, that he was at odds with people inside. He very much was more of an independent operator than a lot of people on the president's team, that he had some tensions with Susie Wiles, who's the chief of staff running things over there, and that there, it wasn't an acrimonious thing, but it was clear that he wasn't a perfect fit for what they wanted to do. And you heard the vice president tell Brett, listen, we needed him to do certain things at NSC. He did a great job at getting those things done. We think he's a better fit over at the UN. Democrats are salivating at this confirmation process. They want to rehash Signalgate. They want to drag all those questions out into the open. So it's a little surprising that the administration would be willing to let that story, you know, kind of revive.
So the thing is, Marco Rubio and Mike Waltz, when they were in Congress and Senate, respectively, they had the same views on Ukraine, on Iran. We know their careers. They've been very outspoken. They're very aggressive. They don't shrink. So if Waltz and Rubio have the same views, why is Rubio's job expanding? Why is he getting the compliments? And Michael Waltz is moving. I don't think the job is bad. I think it's a good job. I mean, you saw what Nikki Haley did with it. She really helped round out her career. But why is he's stepping out of the White House then, if it's pure views?
Well, that is a question, because if you want the views to be tightly aligned, would you send someone to the UN as the president of the United States that you didn't feel like was aligned with you on the UN views?
Exactly.
I mean, that's a question. Some people here say President Trump doesn't view the UN ambassadorship as a really important, critical job. He sort of kind of hates the UN and doesn't really, you know, have a huge interest in what's happening over there. But there have also been concerns that without a U.S. voice in the mix, while we thought, you know, it was going to be Congresswoman Stefanik who was going over there, she had an easy, breezy time going through the Senate process. You know, there is concern that that has left a bit of a hole without us having a voice over there. But it sort of telegraphs, too, that maybe President Trump doesn't think that position is one of the most critical ones for him and his viewpoint.
Yeah, I guess so. Also, in terms of replacements, I've heard Rick Grenell, Michael Anton. I've heard Sebastian Gorka and Stephen Miller. Can you add anything to that list, or take anybody off the list?
Yeah, Steve Witkoff, which It raised some eyebrows when that started making the rounds here in Washington, because while the president respects him as a negotiator and they have a long friendship and he really trusts him with these, you know, tough discussions, he doesn't have the national security background that you would expect for somebody going into the NSA position. But, you know, President Trump does a lot of non-traditional things, and in many ways they work for him and the team he puts together. So I don't think we should be surprised by any name that surfaces.
So I want you to hear what David Ignatius says from The Washington Post. Cut 16.
Beneath the obvious explanation of Signalgate, you see the all the cross currents, ideological, personality, other factors beneath Trump. Trump is really the only solid pole in his administration. There is this ferment underneath Trump, and we saw a bit of it, I think, in yesterday's action. Waltz will be away from the White House, where there wasn't good chemistry between him and Trump. And interestingly, Marco Rubio, who used to be seen as on the outs, has managed to charm his way into Trump's inner circle, has been very supportive. Never see Marco Rubio say anything but great job, Mr. President. He's now going to be at Trump's side as the temporary national security advisor. So, you know, Trump world spins underneath, but you must, you know, recognize that there is one person making policy. Don't know what it is from day to day sometimes, but that's Donald Trump.
So,
well, it also reminds you that there is all kinds of stuff that's reported out as fact or with anonymous sources, those kinds of things that aren't true or don't pan out to be true because, as he said, there was this conversation a few weeks ago like, oh, Rubio is sidelined and he's not effective and the president doesn't have great, you know, value on him. And now he's doing these two critical positions. And some of the other people that were named as sort of bubbling up as challengers to Rubio have now fallen by the wayside. So whether that's that President Trump has pivoted or that the reporting was wrong all along, because people like to speculate here in Washington, you be the judge, Brian.
Absolutely. So Shannon, in terms of a trade deal between South Korea, Japan, and India, what seems closest?
It seems like from conversations that we've heard here and from Secretary Bessent that South Korea seemed to be the one that they were really inching toward. They want to get India because that, I mean, all of those are huge trading partners for us. India is obviously a massive market, and they've had some of the highest tariffs on the U.S. I know U.S. farmers, having spent a few weeks ago, we did a whole special hour-long going out and talking to farmers across Kansas and different places. They want access to these markets, and especially a place like India, which is giant and has made it very hard for U.S. agricultural products to get in there. So they're all huge prizes, but it has felt like in the conversations that we've had a sense that South Korea might be closer than the others, but they need to start rolling out these deals in order, again, to give that stability to the markets who believes, all right, this 90-day pause on tariffs, most of them, something's getting done.
So, tapping to your legal background real quick, it looks like the Trump administration has asked the Supreme Court to end the protection status for 600,000 Venezuelans. I'm sure the Haitians and the Nicaraguans would add to that, too. They got special dispensation. That was an executive order. Why are people wrestling with Trump's executive order when they accepted Biden's accepted order? Like, would it just be a reversal?
That's a great question. But listen, as the vice president told Brett last night, they knew that a lot of the things they do would be immediately challenged on this basis, would immediately be dragged into court. And, you know, Vice President Vance, he referenced a number of left-leaning groups that are really well-funded that had this legal strategy ready. They knew they wouldn't have the House or Senate, and that's really the only option they have to challenge the president is to get into court. They know where to file. It's called forum shopping. You go to places where you think you're going to have friendly judges, and it's been successful. At least it's been a mixed bag in the short term. What happens when they get to the Supreme Court is what will really matter, and the case to watch is going to be argued on May 15th, which is going to decide, we think, whether or not these district judges, 600 to 700 of them out there at any one time, can put an entire nationwide policy like these executive orders on hold.
Because we can't try each one individually. Lastly, the Aliens Enemies Act, a Texas judge stopped it. They said you can't use it to throw out Venezuelans. And I just thought, as an amateur, just thought you got to make the case that Venezuela organized this, Maduro, to come in here and create havoc and go after Venezuelans who wanted no part of his regime. Did they not do a good job effectively saying that?
Yeah, I think that this judge and all the other judges where these Alien Enemies Acts come, these cases come forward, you make a great point. They've got to be able to demonstrate that there is some kind of organized armed invasion, which this judge said he just didn't see. He was like, use other immigration laws that you have out there, but don't use this one because I don't think that you have met the statutory definition of an invasion. So if they're going to make that argument, they've got to make it more forcefully and more specifically.
Right. The market now up 400 points. Who do you have on your show, Shannon?
Well, we've got two of the chairs of these House committees that are trying to get the big, beautiful budget done. We've got Chair Jason Smith, Chair Jody Arrington, and they're not exactly on the same page. That's got to happen if they're going to move this thing. We've got Democratic ranking member of the House Intel Committee, Jim Himes, and we've also got the DNC chair who wants to take a victory lap, he says, on President Trump's first 100 days.
Very interesting. Do you want to ask me anything?
What have you got bubbling this weekend on Sunday night, and will there be a dance party?
Yes. No dancing. I thought about the last minute. I have eliminated it from the rundown. We've added a commercial sponsor. Yeah. Governor Huckabee, who's now Ambassador Huckabee from Israel. I think that'll be pretty cool. We have Senator Mark Boyd Mullen, always cool.
Yeah.
And then we have the co-host quiz. If you had a co-host, you'd be eligible. A co-host quiz featuring me as a contestant, Lawrence as the host, going against Ainsley Earhart, who is just going for blood.
I mean, she is a vicious killer. She's competitive, and I need you to know that. She's going to come prepared.
Absolutely. And then Mark Thiessen and Daniel Pletka. So it's a sophisticated yet funny, and Joe Piscopo around everything
out. You've got a little something for everyone, as you always do.
That's what I like to think. We might. I'm going to alert our affiliates now. We might be going over. We can't get it all in 1 hour.
Okay, I'll see you Sunday night.
Shannon Bream, go get him. We'll watch you Sunday morning. Shannon Bream, and then on the channel in the afternoon. Back in a moment.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
What do you think that his confirmation hearing would be like? Considering what we know about Signalgate.
I think it would be pretty brutal. And let's see what happens.
I never say what I'm going to do on a vote until we have the hearings. But I'm not excited about what the behavior was on Signalgate.
It's a sad moment, I think, for Mike Waltz. Then rather resign on principle. He's actually taken a booby prize in being the U.N. ambassador.
So that was Seth Moulton, who is also serving the military, says he's friends with him, but he says he should get out and he's a fall guy for it. I think it'll be fine. Let them come in with fireworks. Same fireworks for RFK, the same fireworks for Pete Hegseth. Mike Waltz can handle it because he's got a fantastic track record. I'd love to see him U.N. ambassador. I hope that gets through quickly. Jerry in Chicago. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Brian, thanks for taking my call, buddy. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
First off, I got to disagree with the congressman that you were talking to earlier. New York doesn't hold the distinction of having the worst governor in the country. I'm sorry. My state holds that of J.B. Pritzker here in Illinois.
But tell him that. He's laughing it up with Jimmy Kimmel last night.
Yeah, well, who cares? Anyway, the reason I'm calling, why is it that whenever there's a vote, The Democrats vote lock, stock, and barrel party line no matter what, even if they know in their soul that what they're voting against is good for the country, okay, because they're afraid of retribution from their party. Now we have the Republicans. First of all, they look like they don't know how to be in charge. Whenever there's a vote on something that's good for the country, we got hemming and hawing. Oh, I don't know if I could do this, Why can't the Republicans vote like the Democrats when they know that it's good for the country? Why aren't they afraid of party retribution?
Let them grind it out. Remember, that 2 years ago when they got rid of Kevin McCarthy, I was outraged by it. So were you. But they've done a lot better lately. It's okay to go out and have differing views and different approaches for different states and different districts. But when it's all said and done, they have to drop the gloves and get together. So don't get sidetracked by the fighting. They all have their own points of view. They're tough guys and women. Let's see what happens.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
But I also was on the ticket, quite honestly, because I
I could code talk to white guys watching football fixing their truck, doing that, that I could put them at ease. I was the permission structure to say, look, you can do this and vote for this.
Right, exactly. So Tim Walz, again, showing how astute he is on politics. At Harvard, speaking, the governor of Minnesota, about why he was put on the ticket with Kamala Harris. Joining us now, Tommy Lahren, who said this all along. The thing about Tim Walz, every time I say something negative about it, Tommy, you'd always say, but remember, he can code talk to white people, Brian. Yes. So, and you try to rein me in and try to curtail my critiques.
Yes, he's a code talker. He's the ultimate white guy
right.
in his mind. The thing about Tim Walz is he's the last one to know that he is the joke. He is the punchline, and he doesn't realize it. These people that are having him speak, I honestly think it's because it gets him some notoriety. The clip is going to get played. No matter what he says, it's going to go viral somewhere because it's going to be ridiculous. And whoever's asking him, you know, they just want the publicity out of it. But he really thinks that people take him seriously. He is not getting the hint.
Right. He's not. But who is going to get a hint? Is Crockett getting the hint? She thinks this is her time, she said yesterday. And she went on to say that she really believes that she should be the ranking member on the Oversight Committee. She's been there a year and a half, right? She's done nothing but get headlines, make, I think, crazy, embarrassing statements, but got her on Jimmy Kimmel. She's going against AOC and it's going against guys like Steve, I think it's Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts for that spot. Do you think that is there a Democratic establishment to rein her in the way they reined in the squad like Nancy Pelosi did?
I don't think so. And I think when you have people like David Hogg out there saying, hey, listen, I'm going to primary all the stale Democrats, I think that that message has been heard loud and clear. And Carville might not like it, but it doesn't really matter. It's not his party anymore. So I think you're going to see the ones that are able to get attention. They're going to be the ones that are going to rise, at least for the first couple of years. As you get closer to 28, the adults are going to have to come back in the room, you'd assume. But for now, it's going to be who can get as much attention as Donald Trump can. And if you can, then we will make you, I guess, our unofficial poster child.
All right. So I think this is important. So Howard Enten, who's kind of an entertaining pollster, fiscal comedy, you know, they talked about Trump's numbers being bad. But he also pointed out when they put Trump's numbers against other Democrats, he still wins. Listen to him on CNN Cut 38.
If Democrats think that at this particular point, just because Donald Trump is unpopular, that they're going to run away with it like a Heisman Trophy winner, that is not necessarily the case. These numbers should be a major wake-up call for Democrats. Despite Donald Trump's unpopularity in the polls, when you actually go up against him and you put Democrats' names against him, when you put Republicans as a whole up against him, Republicans and Donald Trump do considerably better. And that is why Democrats, in fact, cannot count their chickens just yet, because those eggs have not cracked at this particular moment.
Is that, I mean, that's pretty much it. It's like, okay, you know, you don't like this. Okay, that's pretty expected. 50% of the country didn't vote for you. And then he's doing controversial. Every time you do make a decision, you could be FDR and Lincoln. You're going to tick somebody off. So when you get in and actually do the job, you're going to do it. And that when this guy was smart enough to put him against Democrats, there's no one regrets what's going on right now. And there's no real big surprise, is there?
No, and I also cannot figure out the alternative that Democrats are providing for anybody. You don't like deporting illegal aliens. Okay, we get it. You don't like tariffs. You don't like, I guess, a minerals deal in Ukraine. You don't like anything that he's doing, but you have no alternatives. The only alternative that's being provided is by Bernie and AOC, who are saying free things for everybody. That's the only alternative I'm hearing, because they don't offer anything else. So if you hate everything he's doing, you have to have an alternative. They have none. Mm-hmm. It's just, we hate him. Well, that's going to get old, and it's gotten old, and you're not providing anything for anyone to get excited about.
So they're looking to dig in on certain areas. For example, the deportations. And Kilmar Borrego Garcia is the one they were diving into. Not so much this week as prior weeks. But this week, last night, Fox Digital was able to obtain video of the 2020 pullover by a state policeman when this Maryland man, was able to pick up at least 8 people from Texas and looked to be driving into, I think, Illinois, in order to human trafficking. Now, it's not Tommy Lahren saying this, Tommy. It's not Brian Kilmeade saying it. The cop at the time looked into the camera and explained what he was seeing. They shut down the camera for 10 minutes, at which time we understand they called the FBI. The FBI said, take pictures, let him go. That's Christopher Wray's FBI.
Yeah. And it was in Tennessee, which is my home state, which really bothers me because I'm wondering how many more Kilmar Abrego Garcias were doing the exact same thing in Tennessee or any other state. And you have your great law enforcement officers calling in saying, we see this as a problem. And they're like, yeah, let it go. It's catch and release. Catch and release in every instance. But you realize that you're letting these people just go and who knows what they're going to do. Particularly for me, when living in Tennessee, I'm like, so this guy was just driving through my state. Who knows what else he was going to do? Who knows the people he's got with him? We're a tourist state. We're the bachelorette capital of the world. You're just going to let these people just go on and just hope for the best? I mean, that's really what it was. Like, we'll just hope for the best.
Right. So you think that right now, possibly some Democrats are wondering, should we go into bat for this guy?
Well, it's due process. Brian, that's the new. It's not Marilyn Mann anymore. It's due process. I think that's a hard sell to your everyday American.
It's still Marilyn Mann today in the Washington Post. It still said Marilyn Mann because evidently there's a pushback among his stories written up today's Washington Post where they talk about a 16-year-old fleeing from a gang, rival gang, getting to our border and getting in and the relief the family felt because they were being harassed so significantly over in El Salvador. Ilhan Omar was asked by a reporter, the Daily Caller, is she still going to bat for Garcia? Cut 39.
Do you think more of your Democratic colleagues should be traveling to El Salvador to advocate on behalf of Abrego Garcia?
I think you should off.
Yeah, that's
I'm sorry, what, Congresswoman? Who should?
You.
Why me?
We're not taking any questions right now, but here you go.
Yeah, thanks.
I love that he goes, really? Which I make him repeat it and then said, why should I do that? Like, what did I do? I love it. Like, just to, does she think that that's a good PR move or has the squad hit their head on the ceiling?
They're so hostile and they're so just unpleasant and nasty. And they've always been that way. They're never happy. I've never seen them happy.
Look at the kid she raised. Yeah. That angry kid protesting at Columbia.
Yeah, it's anger and it's a hatred for America, which is incredible because you're somebody who really benefited from the compassion of this country. That's a whole other thing, though. Democrats will still go to bat for Kilmar Abrego Garcia. They'll just say even the worst of the worst get due process. And it just so happens that due process is going to take 30 million years. But you know what? That's fine. Due process.
So Senator Chris Van Hollen, who famously went over there and did every Sunday show 2 weeks ago, was asked yesterday, now that it comes to light about two separate domestic abuse charges where his are they married? Okay, they're married. Beat her twice, where she's scared for her life, and then he got an order of protection two separate times. And now we find out about the trafficking caught on video. Cut 23.
I have repeatedly said that we're not vouching for Kilmar Abrego Garcia. We are vouching for his constitutional rights, because if you trample over his constitutional rights, you threaten them for every American and everybody who resides in America.
Really? Am I right in danger? Yeah. If the human trafficker here illegally who beats his wife and joins a gang, if he gets deported, I'm going to get deported?
So here's, again, what's going to be a hard sell to the American people. What you're saying is you think that this man getting his umpteenth day in court, you think that that is more important than the safety and security of Americans who have to live near him and have them in their communities. You want them to play Russian roulette and just hope that this guy's next trial will go well. That's what they're saying here. They're saying that these people, they deserve more of the benefit of the doubt, even though they came to this country illegally, even though they're suspected gang members, they deserve more of the benefit of the doubt than the American that's like, I don't want this in my community.
And you know, the thing is, when the Department of Justice attorney said, you know, we made a mistake, we shouldn't have deported him, I thought, okay, maybe they did. But the more you think about it, they didn't make a mistake. He was on the list of MS-13 people on slate to be deported that the previous administration had no interest in doing. So they get to him and they say, yeah, well, even if you looked at it and say, why can't he go to El Salvador? Well, the gang, his rival gang, is no longer in existence, and his gang is literally all jailed. So we'll send him to the jail where they can have meetings again. So he's gone, right? Trafficking, domestic abuse. He does profile exactly the same way. So I don't know what they're talking about overall, but I think if they dig in, it's a huge mistake, and I think the president knows that. You have to do Outnumbered, right?
I do.
Are you going to play yourself on that show?
I am, and right. I'm wearing black today as my color on the wheel, if you couldn't tell. So I decided to bring, you know, the I guess, the positive vibe of black to the other colorful ladies on the table.
Can I play one more bite before
Please.
You go? So who is? So we pointed out that Ilhan Omar isn't the future, that AOC might be popular. We'll see. Then we also pointed out Kamala Harris in the past. Terrible speech this week.
The elephants.
But what about Wes Moore?
Okay.
He was on The View. Listen to what he said. Cut 42.
I think that means you have to run. Are you going to run?
I am not running.
You're not?
I'm not running.
It's saying that. You're saying that for sure?
I'm not running. I'm really excited about the work that's happening right now in the state of Maryland.
So I think that was interesting. All he had to say was, I'm keeping all my doors open. I mean, Tulsi Gabbard said, I'm keeping all my doors open.
No, this is strategic. Nobody wants to be the face of the Democrat Party right now.
Interesting.
And if he says, I'm thinking about it, then all of a sudden he's thinking about it. You don't want to be associated with Democrats right now. Not right now. So he's smart. And there's going to be others that are going to wait in the wings. They're going to wait for this circus to play out. And then they're going to come in and they're going to be the more stable voice of reason. They don't want any part of this right now. And that's very wise. Let all these other clowns, you know, parade around, the court jesters, and the ones that are actually serious, they're not going to surface for probably another 2 years.
Tommy Lahren, I hope you surface on Outnumbered at the top of the hour.
Is that okay? It down the stairs to the couch.
No, you know what we're going to do? I'm going to send you in an elevator just to make sure. I don't need you to take the stairs from the 15th floor. Tommy Lahren, thanks so much. Catch up to her on Outkick. She's the host of Tommy Lahren is Fearless, which is true. Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Things are moving along very well, and I just wanted to say the final details are coming together, and they're coming together rapidly, and I think we're right on schedule, Mike and everyone. And I want to thank you and this group and all of the people that are over there right now, not in the sun. They're working on the bill. It will be the biggest bill ever passed in the history of our Congress, our Senate, and Congress. That's a big achievement. One of the things that's very important will be saving Medicaid for Americans in need. We will not let the Democrats destroy it.
Yeah, the problem is in saving Medicaid, Barack Obama expanded it so much. The federal government is dependent on funding so much of it. When you try to cut things off the budget, it's a huge chunk of it. And the president says, I'm not cutting entitlements, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. All right. But they want to look at eligibility when it comes to Medicaid. And, of course, Democrats will hang that around Republicans' necks if they do cut it. But it might actually be the responsible thing to do while putting more burden on the states to do what Medicaid's supposed to do. That's supposed to be financed by the states. But as Mike Lawler told us at an earlier time in our show, in New York, if I'm assumed to be a representative of somebody that cut health care in New York, I'm going to lose my purple state. And if you go ahead and pass this bill and almost everybody in a battleground state and a battleground district loses, you're going to have a terrible next 2 years. So that's the tough position you're in, because President Trump went out and said no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on Social Security. So who's going to pay for that? How's it going to pay for in the budget? We'll see. Now, there's a Freedom Caucus, our budget hawks. We're not even talking about Democrats now. They're budget hawks. And I'm not saying necessarily a bad thing, but there's got to be some compromise along the way. Now, on a separate note, we had 177,000 jobs and the market's responding. It's been between four and five, up between 400 and 500 points. And I looked at what Mark Zandi said, and I tried to get a feeling for what it would be like when the job numbers comes out at 8:30, because I'm on television at that time and they want you to respond immediately. If the Mark Zandi, a big critic of the administration, who's the chief economist at Moody's, he said, if the job numbers comes out and there's 150,000, give or take, I will think all has been forgiven. Things are not falling apart. I think things are going to be okay. It's 177,000. All right. Maybe he said that. He's just being honest. Or maybe he said that thinking there's no way they'll hit that, because Doge cut 283,172 jobs totally. Going in, gutting government because they felt at 2.3 million workers, there was too many. Okay. So April saw them cut 105,441. That was over half the cuts in the over the country. But the president's got a vision. Lean out the government, cut back spending, increase defense spending, lower taxes. That's his plan. We'll see how it goes. Now, yesterday, Doge came out and spoke to Jesse Waters, his whole crew there, around a big roundtable, and to give everybody an idea of what they've been up to. And I'm really fascinated to hear these guys, so some of which are, and they're young, they're in their 20s, but how they were just speculating on how bad things were and how they were motivated to do things. In fact, some of these guys dropped out of college in order to serve their country. This is Ethan. He talked about this with Jesse. Cut 45.
I dropped out of Harvard and came here to serve my country. And it's been unfortunate to see, you know, lost friendships. Most of campus hates me now. But I think fundamentally, I hope people realize through conversations like this that reform is genuinely needed. And if there's one, I think this is important to say, if there's one group of people who really have a shot of success, it's the people here. You know, they're up until 2 a.m. Monday through Sunday. Doge does not recognize weekends.
So that is Ethan. He says most of Harvard hates him. That's a plus. Most people at Harvard, as prestigious as that globally acclaimed institution is, for this period, I don't think it's going to be a plus having it on your resume. Here's another guy. His name is Donald. And he talked about there's people within the state government. Not everyone in the federal government is bad. In fact, a lot of them are so glad that there's reform there and modernization taking place. Cut 46.
We are encountering droves of government employees who are missionaries, not mercenaries, who are actually here serving because they believe in what they're doing. They want to do things well. Many, many times, the systems don't give them the information to do that thing. When we give them the tools, when we give them the systems, and we leave behind systems to help them do their jobs better, that's the permanent change. We have exceptional people at all of our agencies. Exceptional.
So he was happy. And when you come in there and all of a sudden make people accountable and you're able to say, wow, where are you from? Silicon Valley, Harvard. Let me just tell you what I've been doing. You know, I've been frustrated because there's no accountability. The one thing that you found, and we all know this, and this is the reason why communism fails and socialism will never work, is because people need personal incentives. You want to make that deli great. You're a parking lot attendant. If you could get there, you could fill up that lot. There's going to be some extra money for you at the end of the month. You make me a shareholder at my huge behemoth of a company. I feel like I'm a part of it. I'm more motivated to do it. It is human nature. That's why capitalism works. But in terms of waste and fraud, there are other people that just want to mail it in, take advantage of the situation. A lot of it is foreign governments. Now, I want to see it translated more than the $150 billion that they saved. My hope that the systems leaning out, making it more efficient, are going to lead to widely acclaimed, nonpartisan benefits for the entire country. I hope that everybody comes in here and gets their own efficiency group. Not a climate group, not an oil and gas group, not a conservative group, not a liberal group, but accountants and actuaries and business experts. Hey, this is my time. I didn't serve in the military, but this is the way I want to give back. Make sure you watch One Nation at 10 o'clock Eastern time on Sunday night. It's going to be a great show with Governor Huckabee, Joe Piscopo, and so much more.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a three-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.